Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today here on WIPR. You can reach us 410-662-8780. And it's April. Cindy was just in Paris, so it's our April in Paris program.
Yay! It was so great.
We realized we hadn't talked about French classics for a while. Mm-hmm. Some of the real sort of foundational things.
And they sort of come to mind.
Things. Yeah, and they,
right?
Since we've been talking about it, we wanted to talk with you about it. And get your calls or your emails either with a question about preparing a dish or with a story about a dish that you had in a particular place on a visit or some masterful cook of a of a great classic French dish and the wines to go with them, because Lord knows it's not possible to
have classic French cuisine without wine. No, not
exactly right.
Unless you don't drink. So yeah, and you know, with the classic dishes, it's always you know, we want to hear if you've tried something. You know, I always think back to that book about Julia Child, when the writer decided to try every single one of her recipes in her original cookbook. And, you know, have you tried to do something that you're just like, oh my gosh, please help me. I don't know what I did wrong. Or, hey, I did this and it was brilliant and I'm so proud, you know, that kind of thing. So let's hear those stories, because I mean, her books really helped the American public have a good handle on classic French dishes and how to approach them. Julia Child.
So, to put you on the spot.
Okay.
You're going to Paris. You sit down. What is the first thing that you want to eat at your first meal?
Whatever the best food is from the chef.
Oh my God. That is such a cop-out.
But that's the truth.
I know.
Okay. So, when I'm in France, I mean, I just want local products. I want their products, because I try to create French food here in Baltimore, which is can be a bit of a challenge just because of the fact that our products are different from theirs. And that's not to say ours are worse or better. It's just simply different. And when it comes to flowers or things like that, that are so organic and different, and the farm animals, you know, the way they're raised, you know, maybe the land that they feed off of, the animal husbandry practices, whatever, things are just different. I mean, okay, the answer to your question is butter.
I believe you.
I want that bright yellow, gorgeous, almost golden, rich, flavorful, that sexy.
That butter that you wonder if it's actually cheese.
Yeah, exactly. It might as well be cheese, quite frankly, because that's the way I put it on my bread.
Oh my God.
Well, as if it were a piece of cheese.
But I'm it requires, see, it's funny because I immediately thought of the opposite half of that.
Mm-hmm.
The bread.
Cream?
The bread.
Oh.
The bread. No, not the cream. Oh, good Lord. The bread.
Okay.
Like, just to smell it. To smell a real baguette.
Mm-hmm. It smells so good. The bread is so incredible. Oh, my gosh. When I sat down, I had I hit the ground running, and but I'm going to jump to the second day, because you're talking about bread, and I had a little treat when I went to L'Amboisie, which is a 3-star, and he is absolutely one of my favorite chefs in the world. And chef sent out, just, you know, once you've settled in, and it's sort of like an amuse-bouche or an hors d'oeuvre, whatever you want to call it, but it was almost a little pre-thing, and it's unusual because it was bread-like. It was definitely sort of somewhere between a bread and a cornbread and a little piece of cake or something, but it was truffle bread. Oh, my gosh. And it came, I could smell it, you know, this gorgeous, just black truffle aroma coming across the dining room when he was just walking with this little piece of bread on this plate. And oh my gosh, it was just, I mean, I wanted to ask for another one. And you know, you're not going to do that because that's not how it works, but it was so delicious. And I will tell you, they tried to remove it.
You restrained yourself?
I did. They tried to remove it from my table at some point, and I'm like, no. And the guy was like, oh God. You know, the fun thing about sitting there was, you know, your assistant, Aunt Sophie, or, you know, the president of our company, whatever you want to call Aunt Sophie, the most important person in our company, is from France. And And she helped me with my trip and some of the arrangements, and or a lot of them. And I had sent her an email and some photographs, you know, saying, hey, you know, I was at L'Amboisie and this was the dish. And I sent her a couple of different photographs. And one of them, I wanted her to see the dining room. And there was the table next to me, and I knew they were fancy people. I, you know, they're dressed beautifully. You know, the woman was gorgeous. All the men had beautiful suits on and perfect shoes, and their hair was perfect, and they were all perfect. And she said, "Chef, do you know you're sitting next to the Prime Minister of France?" And I'm like, "No, I had no idea." So
you
that
didn't
was kind of cool.
Recognize Macron?
No. Past Prime Minister, excuse okay. me. No, I would recognize him. I would recognize him. This
Sarkozy.
Actually, I'm sorry, not the Prime Minister. The man underneath that, it's not the Prime Minister, which I think of as the President. I'm sorry, yeah. I can't remember his title, but one of the ministers of France. Yeah. It was a minister of France, not someone like the President.
Okay.
I would recognize all of the presidents of France, I think, for the last probably 20 years. But yeah, so that experience. But anyway, you're talking about the bread. And yeah, every time I open a piece of bread, it's just, you know,
it's funny. My 2-year-old, when she gets bread, she says, "Open it." She wants you to open it for
funny.
Her.
That's funny. That's cute.
Break up the crust because she can't get
you
to it.
You open the bread. There you go. but yeah, I mean, it's just so earthy and beautiful, and often has a sourdough starter to it. You know, you can just smell that, like, sort of sour, wonderful in a good way, sort of thing, and just all the flavor of the smell of the flour and whatever, and the ingredients. And yeah, I'm with you though. But the butter, my gosh, when that first piece of butter goes down on the table, and they have so much, you know, it's always on a beautiful dish and a 3-star. It's always got, you know, when I went to Le Cinq, which is in the Four Seasons in Paris, that was my last dinner in Paris, and a friend of mine is working there. And so I had never intended to eat there, and just sort of one thing led to another, and I ate there, and their butter presentation was on this gorgeous white and gold plate that had a dome that was, you know, the size of my hand in height over it, and it had, you know, Le Cinq on it in gold letters. I mean, the whole thing was just, it was a beautiful piece of crystal. I mean, that's the thing I think about,
over the top.
Being in every detail of a 3-star is just perfection, every detail.
The thing I appreciate, though, is in France, in an awful lot of the small villages, you can find an excellent bakery that's going to produce a baguette that's every bit of what's being served in that 3-star.
Yeah, knock your socks off. Oh, definitely.
And
absolutely.
And you can find butter that is superb, beautiful.
Everywhere.
You know, and
in markets.
And individually seasoned with different particular kinds of sea salt and coming from different regions of France. And that it's a little bit like, you know, You're an amateur of the piano in a nation full of professional piano players. You know, they're like the bread. the bread and butter tells you right away that this is real. That every little bit, that first thing that happens, you know, that breaking bread means something.
Absolutely.
You know, that
Absolutely.
Is that is definitely a thing about the table in France. So the first thing on my list after bread. Oysters.
Mm.
In Paris, first thing, I don't know exactly when it started, and I know when you see all the stands on the side of
various
bistro, you know, all the different huîtres, coquillages, you see all the signs.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty cool that you can walk down the street and right on the outside of the restaurant, basically, you know, there's a shucker, and you know, you can just walk right up and
it's like an ice cream takeaway, except that it's
oysters,
it's full of ice
oysters.
And oysters and
all kinds of good procedures.
And you can get a glass of muscadet or if you're feeling highfalutin, get a good glass of champagne and.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, oysters. That's
so you seek that out when you go.
I want to smell it. You know what I mean? And that's one of those things
absolutely.
I love our oysters in the States, and they're diverse and they're amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like going to Paris, the first thing.
Mm-hmm. Again, it all comes down to the environment. I mean, their water, their oceans and waterways are different from ours. And so things are going to taste different. And, you know, maybe a pollution level is different or whatever it is. But things affect the way that seafood tastes very dramatically. And obviously all the farming product.
Let's go to a first call from Frank in Mount Washington. Frank, how are you?
Hey, Frank.
Good morning, Tony and Cindy. How are you?
Good.
Good to hear from you.
Good, good. Good to talk to you guys. Listen, I know, Tony, you grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in Baltimore. I want to know from you all generally why we Americans let our bread just go to crap. You know, here in Baltimore, growing up in the 50s, this was a city of bakeries. I mean, there was Rice's and Schmidt's and Oswald's and then the ethnic bakeries and Stone's and Pariser's. And you could, in the early morning, as people were, the morning rush hour began, there was the smell of baking bread all over town, and it was wonderful. And now, certainly we have ethnic bakeries, and if you want good bread, it's going to be French bread or German bread or Jewish rye or whatever. But American bread, you know, is just that. Why? How did we let that happen? And,
well,
what can we do to get it back?
a couple of things. One, do you remember Maranto's, the Italian bakery?
Oh, yeah.
For a long time, my grandmother Foreman used to get a loaf of that every day delivered to her house from like 1920 until, you know, until they stopped home delivery of the bread.
That is
pretty amazing stuff. And I agree with you. There were a lot more bakeries, and people were fussy about it and would drive to, you know, or travel to wherever the bakery was that had the bread that they liked.
Sure. And get an Italian meatball sub, where what they would do would take a small loaf of Italian bread and then kind of hollow out the inside and stuff the meatballs down in there and then cap it off with the end of the loaf again. And that was your meatball sub. Oh.
Yeah, the only way to improve upon that sub is a nap.
And Rice's Bakery, they had the most wonderful raisin bread. And one of the best sandwiches was their raisin bread, a grilled cheese sandwich on raisin bread. Mm-hmm. And, it's just, you know, get a good cheese, you know.
That's the thing. With strong cheese, you can do that. Otherwise, it's going to be very odd.
That's right.
I would say, in general, the bread production has become, over the years, a giant industry and much more centralized. And when that happens to anything having to do with food, it takes out a lot of the individual personality, and it takes out a lot of the individual direct relationships from land, you know, much more directly to consumer of the food away from it.
Yeah.
So if you're not, you know, if you're using a commercial oven and you're not using a wood burning oven and a giant stone and real paddles and real bakers and real starters and really good flour from a particular mill. I mean, for us, one of the things that we were crazy about over the years is trying to figure out how to have a great bread program. I mean, that's, and I think you see a comeback of a lot of that stuff,
sure.
Frank, but in small places and in farmers markets, you can find things sometimes in individual restaurants that have programs, you can find things, but there's not that like neighborhood by neighborhood,
right.
variety. Maybe that will grow a little bit.
And the palate. I mean, I think we have gotten to the point that, you know, good bread is available now, and I think a lot of people really are passing up the, you know, wholesome soft twists for, you know, actual bread.
I think. The difference between what looks like good bread or even looks like a real baguette or something like that and what actually has that flavor and that integrity are two different things. We've gotten very good and sophisticated at producing a lot of something that looks like good bread, but not that many things yet have the real content. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing to see what happens in the next probably decade or so.
Yeah, and Cindy, I'm not sure if you are aware of this, but I know that at the Eddie's market, they do their croutons out of whatever bread was left over from the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a blend of, you know, whatever was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, you know, cut and toast it. And boy, when you get to your salads, and I also use that in making stuffing for turkey at Thanksgiving.
There you go.
And so every time it's going to be a little bit different because it just depends on what bread was
what day old is left. That's smart.
Sure.
Very good. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks as always for your
we love hearing from you, Frank.
Comments.
Okay.
Thank you. Have
Bye-bye.
A good Sunday.
Bye.
So you can clearly reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we're going to run through a good number of French classics. We're really slow with the bread and butter because that's a big deal.
Yes.
For us. And we'll be back shortly on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. I like to do
Tony. You had to remember that you were actually here and not in France. That's what's going on.
Oh, and such a beautiful day outside. I'm a little daydreamy.
So we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780. We're talking about France, French classic dishes, mm-hmm. The wines that go with them. And Cindy was recently in France and trying to
eat as much as humanly possible.
Well, I was going to say doing research with competitors for very elevated detailed cuisine.
Yes.
In a number of the Michelin guides' favorite restaurants in France. So
very good research.
So what was the single best dish that you had?
Oh my gosh, that's very, very hard to say, but I'm just going to go straight to a dish that surprised me. And that's why I'm going to say it was the best. It was like a pithivier. It was a circle of puff pastry. The top had curved slits in it, so it was very, very pretty. It was nice golden brown pastry. And it had in the very, very middle a piece of foie gras, but all the other meat, it was grouse. It was a dish based on grouse. And all around it were all these different parts of the grouse, and probably, you know, I'm kind of thinking there were some sweetbreads in there, and I have a feeling, I know he was serving lamb sweetbread, so I think there was a little bit of lamb sweetbread in, but it was just all this diced up, you know, livers and all these incredibly just rich and beautifully executed meats and in this pastry. And with the little bit of foie gras in the center was the most tender, obviously the most tender thing. So it sort of melted, a little bit melted into all the other meats and coated it with its fat. And then the sauce was obviously made from all the hearts, the gizzards, all the parts, and great red wine, and definitely had liver tone to it, and probably veal stock and bird stock, and wow, and I think one of the great things about making a bird
it wasn't rich, was it?
Yeah, it was. one of the great things about making a bird stock is that inherently there's this just gorgeous sweet tone to a bird stock, in my experience. So yeah, I definitely had to have some duck or game or birds, whatever, or more than one different type of bird. But yeah, it wasn't that big of a portion. It was actually a small pastry, so it wasn't overwhelming from the standpoint of eating too much. You know, yes, it was intensely flavored, and I don't even think of it as, honestly, as being rich. I just think of it as having tremendous flavor and great texture and flavors maybe that I hadn't had before. And then the reduction sauce was just so unbelievably good. And there was an accompaniment, and I honestly didn't need it because I was so enamored with this dish the way that it was. But yeah, it was. There were many great dishes on the trip, but that was one that I will never, ever forget.
That sounds super remarkable.
It really was.
Two questions for you about it. Mm-hmm. One, what did you drink with it?
I was drinking the Reyes at that point. Oh. So a 2006 Chateau Reyes from Chateauneuf-du-Pape, which you suggested that I cheat when I go to restaurants, when I get when the lists on a 3-star can be very, very long. And one of my favorite regions is Chateauneuf-du-Pape. And when I see that and I know I'm also committing some money to something, I want to make a very good decision. And I am not the best at knowing years. And I will often, as you know, Tony, ask you to help me with that. And I shot you a photograph of that section of the list, and you suggested that.
Yeah, you did a great job of making me feel very jealous at that kind of that moment.
Well, and the night before, I had had the Bonneau, Henri Bonneau, and that wine was, and I went on this trip by myself. So obviously, I'm not going to drink a bottle of wine at dinner. I could, but I'm not going to. And so
a single serving size.
Yeah, right. So they were nice enough to say, hey, you know, we're happy to, you know, open the wine, decant it, do whatever needs to be done to half of the bottle, you know, let you have that tonight. Then they, you know, take care of it for me overnight so that then the next evening I could have the other half of that wine. And when that happened, I had actually gone to lunch and had one glass of the wine. So I cut into it and then decided to, so I had the Bano left over and then I went into the Reyes for the next two nights. And to have those two together, that was really, really fun because they're very different from the same.
Yeah, Reyes in many ways drinks like a Burgundy. That's one of the things that when you're describing the dish, I'm thinking, oh, I'd like to have some very good Cru Burgundy from 20 years ago, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The world's most, you know, most refined, detailed Pinot Noir.
Why is that so set apart from, like, I swear, from everybody else? I just feel like that house is the best in that region. Do you agree? And two, why is it that I feel that way?
I love Reyes. Reyes is very individual in its circumstance. The growing conditions are slightly different there than the rest of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. The soil is definitely different than an awful lot of Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
How so?
It's a sandy soil.
Oh.
And
not the rocks?
Relatively shallow and really, really poor organic material. The rootstock has to dive very deep in the soil in order to survive, and which is a little unusual for sandy soil. And Jacques Reynaud, who was the famous winemaker who passed away, 97, I want to say, and love the man and super, super duper talented, a real magician in what he was doing, established a particular style that was not as extracted as some other producers of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. Historically, a lot of those wines were just super beefy, and there were always stems in the fermentations, and there was a little bit of rustic tannin in the wines. And long before, you know, in the 60s, he parted ways with that historical style and made this really beautiful Lacy. I mean, still big body. There's still, you know, robust alcohol in those wines.
But that's elegant. Like you and I were talking about, and you said the word elegant.
And the tannins are fine tannins in those wines. One of the things when you look analytically at the best wines of Burgundy, you have very abundant but fine tannins sort of more and more and more as you go up the scale from a village level wine to a Premier Cru to a Grand Cru. So it's an interesting and very individual wine. And yeah, I like it, but I almost don't think of it the way I think of other Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And
I
don't use it with food exactly the same.
It is sort of sets itself apart from everything. I understand what you're saying. And the Bano, the two together just seemed like, you know, siblings, you know, but fighting a little bit, you know.
Siblings, Bano is the kid in the back row. You know, he's got the spitballs.
Yeah, definitely.
He's going to steal your lunch, you know.
Well, I felt like it was, you know, and this is in a good way, a little dirty. So, yeah, I agree.
That leads to an immediate association. Henri Bono told me the finest, funniest, very off-color joke that I cannot ever repeat.
Well,
in French or try to parallel in English.
It's just good that you met him.
Can we, and he's passed away, God rest him. Can we talk about fish?
Sure.
What the French do with fish.
Oh, yes.
Those marvelous flat fish.
Oh, yeah. Turbo,
like sole. Well,
turbot
can be an awful lot bigger than sole, but things like sole meunière, I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people could probably
make at home.
If not sole, you know, other fish that are available
in
the States.
Some sort of flat fish, definitely.
Fluke. Mm-hmm. There's good fluke available in the States.
Flounder.
So maybe take a second and talk about how to execute one of those dishes.
So it is a flat fish. So it's a thin fish, and these fish are sweet and pretty. And you lightly dust it with flour if you want. You should use clarified butter to cook the fish, and get a nice wide pan working, get it hot, not to the smoking point. Add your clarified butter, lightly dust the fish, shake it off, salt it, and then go into the pan and brown it on both sides. This fish that I had a sole with a Grenoblois at Chez George, which is one of my favorite bistros in Paris. And it was, sole is to me one of the most beautiful fish ever. I just love it. And to get it so fresh as it was and cooked absolutely perfectly, it was tender. It almost was falling apart, not in a badly overcooked way, but just the fish was just so tender. And, you know, just the perfect brown butter. So I would knock everything out. I would either knock everything out of that pan after the fish is done or do it on the side. But that's sort of a restaurant thing. At home, you can easily do it in the same pan. Add cold butter to that pan after the fish is done. Let it rest somewhere for a moment in the oven, in a low oven or just on the counter or near the stove, and let that butter brown. And it takes a couple of minutes, and finish with lemon and a little bit of hand-chopped parsley.
How do you know when it's brown?
You want it to be brown, but you do not want beurre noisette in this case, I don't think. You if you take it too far, it will begin to taste burned.
So the color is
past golden towards a good-looking brown. Just good-looking brown. Don't go to black.
So it's more
because that's going to be a burned.
It's more tan than black.
Yeah, it is definitely brown. Yeah. Yeah. And what you're doing is obviously you're browning the milk solids and the fat. And it's nutty. It smells so good. I mean, and then that little bit of, did I say lemon? You add lemon to it, and obviously that's what you love with the fish. And then, I mean, it's just perfect. It's just the perfect, simple thing. But if you execute it correctly and you don't take it too far or do it too little, I mean, if it doesn't start to brown, you're not getting what you need.
You
just pour it over the top of the fish.
You know it really by smell, right? You know it has that nutty.
If it smells good, you're probably done. You know, if you're
it's that nutty, popcorny almost kind of aroma.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you can add capers to the dish if you like. You know, that is the next step.
Anything that you add to it, you add at the very, very end. You don't want to fry it in the fat.
No.
You just want it to be a garnish and a flavoring agent.
Right.
And go right on the fish.
Yeah. And I would use just a couple of paper towels to wipe out that fish pan maybe, you know, before you go to add the hot butter, the new butter to it, just to make sure there aren't any particles in there that you're not thrilled with.
Maybe use those paper towels with tongs because that hot pan's not going to be friendly to you.
Right. Yeah.
So if you have a memory of a favorite trip in France or a French dish that you love to make at home or that you wish you could make at home, if you need help with a recipe or an interpretation of a French recipe.
A memory of Julia Child.
Yeah.
Maybe watching the shows when you were.
You can give us a call, 410-662-8780, mm-hmm. or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. Mm-hmm. Those flatfish, whitefish in France.
You love them.
I do love them. And to some extent, it's because they're right out of the water and in front of you pretty darn quickly. Mm-hmm. France is not that big. France is, you know, 80% of the size of Texas.
Right.
Which means that things coming from furthest ports, you know.
Yeah, it's not very far.
Are coming fast.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm always amazed by when I'm in France and look forward to eating are langoustines. And they are just so delicious. And to me, it's a little bit like a... you know, somewhere between a shrimp and a lobster, but they have very good flavor. And I will tell you right now, the first time I worked with langoustines in this country, they were not fresh as they should have been. You know, the moment I was learning how to work with them, I put them in the pan, I start sautéing them, like, what is happening with these things? And I don't like the way they smell. So, I mean, it is so important that langoustines are fresh, which leads back to your conversation, which is, you know, they're there. They're not that far away. They're going to be very, very fresh when they cook them. And they're just such little treats of sweet seafood goodness. And I had a dish on this trip that was a curry cream, and the chef had done a paper-thin sesame twill, and there were two layers of the twill. There was wilted spinach, and it almost had some sort of almost like a smoked ham hock tone to it. And I know it didn't, but there was some sort of smoke that the chef put into these wilted spinach.
And a twill is a really super skinny, flat cookie,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right. And it can be a twill also means a tile, the word tile. And, you know, it's just it's funny when you're in this that part of France, in the southwestern part of France, the roofs are almost all made with tiles and they're curved. And that's what, you know, that's where the curved twill came from, which is that the pastry chefs would just put that cookie right out of the oven. They're paper thin coming off of a sheet pan and going on to laying onto the tiles, roof tiles, and then obviously then you have the curved twill. But these were flat, that very low sugar, obviously, because this is a savory dish. The sesame addition was great, and I love sesame seeds, so that was exciting to me. But there were probably 8 or 9 langoustines just perfectly cooked in between the layers of this dish, and I mean, that is something that I immediately did my own version with when I came back. And, you know, it was for me, my version, I made it with crawfish instead of the langoustines because that is what we're celebrating this time of the year. So
yeah, well, like that's to your first point. I mean, the products are going to change when you change locales.
Yep, exactly.
That's one of the interesting individual things about cooking. I mean, that's when you like to, I like to, a lot of people like to celebrate French cooking, French cuisine. We have to do it with materials that are a little bit different. That makes a unique individual expression of that cooking tradition.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, I mean, I was talking to my cooks about it because, you know, they were asking me, chef, all these new dishes that we're doing this past week, you know, are these inspired by your trip? I'm like, yes, of course. And, you know, but and they would say, you know, how do you go about this process and how do you make decisions to what you're going to do? And for me, it is I'm going to put my twist on something unless I love it so very, very much. I actually might try to duplicate it, but it's rare because usually I'm going to do what I want to do.
You're always going to do what you want to do.
Yes.
Let's go to Diana, who's got a Julia Child memory. Diana, go ahead.
Oh, well, can I first ask my question about French bread?
Yeah, sure. Please do.
I had heard that the reason our bread is not as good as French bread is because we use preservatives. And it is true. I live with a family in France one summer, and they do go shopping for a baguette every day.
Wait,
or at least they did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of commercial bakeries do use preservatives. And while that was a wonderful and very practical advance, that's a very different thing from the traditional baguette. And yeah, I mean, I want it every day. And a good bakery in France is going to make bread probably 3 times a day.
But but if we were to make like at one of the restaurants, we would never put preservatives in our bread.
No, we don't.
So that's the difference, you know.
So it does alter the flavor.
It does. It also it alters the natural evolution of.
I was going to say it alters the performance
the
product. Of the product.
Yeah,
yeah. It alters the way that the bread. Yeah, but I mean, if you're going to a restaurant, a good bakery in the United States, they're not going to have preservatives in their bread. I would be very surprised by that. But with a baguette, it is necessary absolutely to get it fresh every day because they just become almost rock hard by the next day. And that's why, you know, we do often make toast points and croutons and things from that bread because it's perfect at that point for that. You had a memory of Julia Child?
Yeah, this is actually my sister-in-law was in journalism, and she once interviewed Julia Child, and they became fast friends.
That's great.
That's nice.
And they invited her to dinner, and I said to my brother, what are you going to do? Because he's the cook of the family. And he said, we're going to cook at home. And I said, are you going to have the kids at the table? Because they had 4 young ones. They were all like 6 and under.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
About 1995.
Wow.
So he did cook for her. He cooked a chicken dish, and he put a lot of time into selecting the right wine. And then she came to dinner, and she wouldn't drink. And all she would say was, I have bad legs. And, of course, the family spent a lot of time scratching her heads over what that might mean. But it was just kind of ironic that he put so much time into the wine choice, and she didn't drink any.
That's a shame, because that normally, with our experience of Julia Child, she did not struggle drinking something, and especially something good. So I'm sure it may have been a temporary issue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's amazing that she, you know, was with your family. Thank you for that, Diana.
Sure.
Have a good Sunday.
Thanks, Diana.
Thanks, you too.
So you can reach us with a favorite memory of a trip to France or a particular meal that you had there, a French dish that you love to produce or have produced that's a specialty that you want to brag about. Or if you want us to help sort out a recipe, you can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we're going to keep mowing our way through a list of French classic dishes on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR. Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today it's all about France. It's April in Baltimore, but we're thinking about April in Paris.
Absolutely.
And Cindy came back recently, so we put together a list of, you know, sort of archetypal French dishes, French foods. And she's sneaking a few highlights in of things that she had that were remarkable on the trip. So the thing, it's funny, and guests often come in when there's duck on a menu. And they're like, well, I don't make duck at home. You know, why?
Which is understandable. It's not the easiest thing to work with.
But you can. Sometimes I'm like,
I'm not telling you can't because you can.
Why not?
I think it's because of the fat. I bet people are scared of it because it's like, you know, it's all fatty and, you know, what do you do? How do you make that good? You know, and the way you make duck fat good it's roasted or sauteed, or seared, it's not like
a chicken. It's a bird, but it's a red meat bird, and you deal with it very differently.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Well, what do you think is the best duck dish you ever had in France?
I think with duck, it's that roasted bird. Well, and confit. Oh, okay, I'm going to just go to confit. I'm just going to move backwards and go to confit. That is the best dish because it is cooked with aromatics and, you know, maybe a little bit of red wine, but mostly it's immersed in duck fat, the legs. And the fat is still on the legs, which the legs have a tremendous amount of fat on them. And to season them properly and cook them low and slow, you know, you're talking about 180, 200 degrees immersed in fat for a very long period of time, probably 4 or 5 hours. Until they're nice and tender. And I mean, it just really is. And then when you go to eat it, you really want to recrisp that skin. And that's an essential part of eating a duck leg confit.
Yeah, I mean, if we're not going to give you a complete recipe for confit of duck leg, the origin of, and because that honestly is something you can look up Bocuse's version. It's a great version. It is something that's remarkable. And if you put the time and effort into it, it is literally a way of preserving duck.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of preserving meat.
And the way to preserve it is you have to leave it immersed in that fat, completely covered, and in a refrigerator. Then you can keep it for, you know, I wouldn't, but you could keep it for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days probably. Don't do it.
Yes, it's definitely the ultimate, like, prepare ahead. Super satisfying dish.
Well, and talking about duck, I had squab on the trip, and oh my gosh, their squab is bigger than ours, the ones that I get.
Another red meat bird.
And squab, on the other hand, is lean, unlike magret, which is very fatty, or duck, which is very fatty. And so with the squab, the whole bird was deboned, not one bone left. And then it was stuffed with foie gras and herbs and roasted, seared beautifully, roasted over. Chef Gerard has a wood fire going, you know, like a fireplace going in his kitchen that is one of the ways that he cooks. And he has all these, you know, sort of things in that fireplace that he can cook birds and do other, you know, grill things and do all kinds of things in this fireplace. And it was cooked in there, and the wood smoke, oh my goodness, that bird was so good. And it was nicely sliced and laid out on the plate and had all sorts of local vegetables. Oh, and the other good thing, you know, piece of advice, go to France in the springtime for the morels and the asparagus.
That's funny. Mushrooms are on my list.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, so we can talk about that.
Because those guys deal with mushrooms as well or better than anybody.
I agree. And, you know, the morels on this dish and the fresh asparagus and the reduction sauce, again, you know, the sauce made obviously from a squab and oh my goodness, I mean, the flavors were just incredible, but that bird was so tender. And I always sear squab, get the skin really crisp and pan roast it to medium rare, This was very gently cooked all the way through. And I was not surprised, because obviously Chef is one of the best chefs in the world. He knows what he's doing. But it was interesting to have something, and I'm so used to having medium rare, cooked gently all the way through and have it be so tender and so delicious and really, really gorgeous. So that was an exciting course to have.
That's something that duck and squab both are a great excuse to have Bordeaux. And the more mature the Bordeaux can be, the better off you are in that situation. But that's something that it is very hard to improve upon, that partnership.
Yeah, and that's where Michel Garrard's restaurant is. It's just south of Bordeaux. So he has a tremendous amount of Bordeaux on his list.
He does. I've definitely cherry-picked that here and there a bit. An email from a listener, Ronnie in Baltimore. My grandmother used to make a beef bourguignon that was the most comforting dish I've ever had. It felt like home. I am a complete novice in the kitchen and want to try to make the dish.
Oh.
I sadly never got her recipe before she passed. Is this a difficult dish to execute? Can you give me some tips for success with beef bourguignon?
Mm-hmm. You need a decent...
What cut of beef first?
Well, that's a good question. I would probably use the shoulder, but you could use any off cut that needs to, you know, obviously you're not using a primal cut. You're not using, you know, something that's expensive. You're using, you know, meat that needs to be cooked gently and for a long period of time so it will be tender. I would ask my butcher what he would suggest.
There's a restaurant in Gevers-Chambertin called Chez Guy. Mm-hmm. And Chez Guy does an excellent version of this dish that with beef cheeks.
Oh, well, that would be fun.
And it's beef cheeks.
And that's
cheeks.
Not traditional to use cheeks.
No.
That's awesome, though. I like that.
But, I mean, Gevers-Chambertin is a village in Burgundy. I figure they have the cred. They have the cred to be to take an audible on this one.
They can do whatever they want.
And they cooked it for 12 hours in Gevers-Chambertin.
Goodness.
Very, you know, very, very, just simmer it with the wine. Beef fat, the split leg bones after they've been, the leg bones been roasted, and lots of shallots and a little vinegar.
Okay. And that's unusual. That's, yeah.
Yeah. And then they make all the rest of the business into a sauce.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's not totally traditional, but oh my gosh, that's my very favorite version.
Well, to answer this gentleman's question, I would sear the beef. So you want a good open, wide open surface with, you know, get it to the smoking point. You need a neutral oil, so corn oil or canola oil, something with a high flash point. Get that pan hot. That meat needs to be dry. Pat it off and get ready to be splattered. Have long sleeves on, hopefully long tongs, and seriously, get ready to be splattered because you will be. But pat the meat so it's not doesn't have any extra moisture on it. Go right into the pan, only one thin layer. Get it brown. I'll do this as quickly as I can. Get it brown on all sides, and as you don't overload the pan. If you overload the pan, you bring the temperature down too quickly, and then the meat will start to boil instead of brown. And as you can do it in batches. If you want to, you know, do a batch, make it brown, put it onto a sheet pan, and then go in with your next batch. Make sure your pot isn't getting too brown on the bottom, but then add your mushrooms. I would add shallots, a little bit of onion, deglaze with a red wine. You're going to have a stock. So I would suggest veal and chicken stock and cover that. And I would add a little bit of aromatics in the form of bay leaf and peppercorn. You could put it in a sachet, which is to take a piece of cheesecloth, put those whole things in there, tie it up, and tie it to the side of your pot so you don't lose your sachet and your cooking. And let it braise low and slow, very gently. You can either do it on your stovetop on very low heat, covered, or in the oven at low heat. And just let it gently cook for a couple of hours. It doesn't have to be 12.
Once you've browned everything, it goes back in the pan and is covered with
the meat and, yeah, everything goes together. And then you can, you know, pull out your sachet when it's done and garnish it with maybe cipollini or pearl onions, maybe new button mushrooms. But that is a bourguignon.
Let's go to a caller has advice about beef bourguignon.
Hi, Nate.
Nate, how are you?
Hi. It's wonderful to be back on the show. I know time is short. I wanted to share with your listeners, I make this every year for my friend George, and the The one thing I give myself is at least 3 days from the time I purchase meat. I allow my butcher to cut it, to cube it for me because it's a time saver. But to really take each step of what you just described, Cindy, and not hurry. It's not something that I ever choose to make and serve that night. I like to give myself 3 days. So that's that. Last piece of advice is blanch those vegetables that are peeled so they, and then put them in that ice bath. You can do that a day or two ahead, even, I've found. And so they preserve that bright color, and then just serve them alongside, or if you want to immerse them, you can, but you don't want those things to become mushy and colorless. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Thanks, Nate.
Good. Thanks, Nate. Right. Good advice.
My pleasure. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Right. It's nice.
Let's talk mushrooms for 1 second. We have a couple of other things to get to, and mm-hmm. we're going to have quick pastry. Favorite mushrooms in France?
Morels.
Morels. Not and, truffles.
Oh, well, but.
No, sorry. Morels. I had a chance to get you there.
Porcini, seps.
Yeah. Porcinis are called seps in France. Mm-hmm. The Girolles. Mm-hmm. I think that's, they come in June. That's always my top of my list. Yeah, mm-hmm. Chanterelles. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Too many.
Well, we already know truffles are my favorite mushrooms.
What is the best, you have 1 minute to tell me about the best pastry that you had on your trip.
I had this white chocolate.
1 minute, 55 seconds.
White chocolate piece of heaven. Well, I'll just say the most exciting part of it, which was that it had like shards of white chocolate glass on it. I don't know how. My pastry chef and I have talked about it like 3 times already. It was just gorgeous. It was literally like thin white chocolate, super shiny. It looked like stained glass or something. It was gorgeous. And then there was a verbena ice cream underneath and had cake crumb. But yeah, that's it. All right. So you only gave me a minute. Go ahead,
Tony. You have 15 seconds.
Oh, no, I'm done. Go ahead. What's yours? What's your favorite French pastry you've ever had in France?
In chocolate mousse.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's very straightforward.
I love chocolate mousse.
So this is when... my older daughter, who is 5, when she was 6 months old, we were in Paris, and there's a small restaurant in the Ile Saint-Louis that I think no longer exists.
No, but, really?
Vestemann, who is the 3-star Michelin chef from Alsace, operated it. At the end of the meal, we got chocolate mousse, very simply served in a bowl with a small piece of puff pastry with it. Mm-hmm. And we gave a little bit of it to the 6-month-old baby. And she looked at us just horrified that we had never given her this food before. Oh. She had this look of betrayal on her face.
That's cute.
And that is definitely the way I feel about chocolate mousse.
All right. I like chocolate mousse too. I'm with you on that.
So, oh my goodness, there's an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah, I wish we could have talked about the suckling pig that I had.
We didn't get to eggs or, mm-hmm. we'll have to sneak a little more France in there. That's a little too easy to go long on these things.
Yes.
And, well, that's leisurely French lunches.
So
right?
When our question is for us, when we're going to have asparagus, Tony, locally, what did the farmer tell you?
A little bit late, probably 22nd, 23rd. We'll get it from the best guy. So thanks for listening. That's all we have time for. If you want to download this episode or any other podcast, go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a whole menu of goodies there. If you want to email us, it's foremanwolf@wipr.org. To follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram, that is populated once in a while, is The Real Tony Foreman. Thanks so much for listening.
And happy Sunday.